Katrina was a wake-up call. For 40 years, New Orleans had been relatively immune to serious losses from hurricanes, and I think a lot of complacency occurred at all levels concerning the real threat of storms like this. I think there has been a lot learned about New Orleans and about hurricane threats and dealing with them from this process, and hopefully we can put all of that to work for the future. But I agree with the previous speakers, it's going to take an integrated, collaborative environment to do this, because it's a very, very complex issue. Katrina came ashore, as you're aware, on the 29th of August in 2005, and here we are over 2 years later. In fact, if Katrina would have taken a different course and gone pretty much directly up the Mississippi River, the surge environment on the east side of New Orleans would have been 3 or 4 feet worse. So we did catch a little bit of a break there, but nevertheless, if you look at the results of that event, they were the worst disaster in the history of this nation. And in fact, if you look at the insurance information, it was the worst disaster globally. Looking at insurance losses, and this does not include fatalities or liability type losses. This also does not include the indirect losses that are far larger than these direct losses. When you start looking at social, cultural issues and the ability to bring back a city that I think was on the brink of the tipping point of being able to recover. I was privileged to lead this task force. It still is. We're trying to finish. Involved 25 universities, 25 private sector companies, and 10 different federal and state local agencies. There were over 300 people that contributed to this, and part of the challenge here was not doing a typical forensic analysis, but it was impacting repairs. It was impacting putting some kind of protection back in place prior to 1 June of 2006, because over 200 miles of the 350 miles of structures, levees and flood walls, were damaged to one degree or another. So it was a huge task to do those repairs, but it was also important to make those repairs with the best technical information available so that the same vulnerability was not built back into the system that was there previously. So our first thrust was to impact repairs, and ironically, our draft report was due 1 June 2006, and the repairs were supposed to be done on 1 June 2006. So we had a bit of a problem there. We had to figure out a way to interact with the design teams and the folks that were trying to implement contracts and marshal the resources to do the repairs. We had to be involved with them literally daily so that whenever something new popped up from the analysis, they could put it to work. Part of the problem with that is when you're working very, very quickly on a huge complex problem, you're not always right, as Chip said. Your science is not always right. Your analysis is not always right. We were fortunate to have a team from the American Society of Civil Engineers that involved social scientists and economists as well as engineers and geotechnical people that really did a real-time peer review of what we were doing, so that we would have more confidence in being able to provide insights prior to the formal process of total validation and so on, that we had confidence that we were giving relevant and good information to the folks trying to fix do the repairs. We also integrated all of that information into a risk assessment. And that's focused on the future. That's focused on really understanding for this entire area what is the residual risk. Now we've looked at that prior to Katrina as a kind of hindcast to say what did the risk look like prior to Katrina. And you can't do that by just looking at what would one storm do. You have to look at a full spectrum of hazards. And we looked at the current situation today, basically June of 2007. And then recently we looked forward about 5 years. What will the residual risk be when a 100-year hurricane protection system that is currently planned is put in place? And that was critical information, I think, for the public. It was critical information for public officials to really understand from a systems perspective and in graphical form, what does this really look like? And what was the situation? What is it now? What is it going to be? So I'm going to lead you through this analysis very, very quickly and then end up with the risk information and talk a little bit about that. All of this, as Henry said, is in a, as of today, 7,835-page report that's on the website. We just, 2 hours ago, put up the Volume 8 on Risk and Reliability. That's the textbook kind of for how we went about doing the risk assessment. We did not publish that. We published the results of that long before putting that on the website because it was so critical to get the risk information out to the public. So that is all available now as of about 2 hours ago. That is just one study. There were two other major studies done concerning Katrina and the New Orleans hurricane protection system. And the good news, I think, is that all of these studies in general agree. The major findings of these three studies are very much aligned and agree on the primary issues. And I think we can take a lot of comfort in that with regard to the way that this information is now being used in the physical design of the future hurricane protection systems. And what I'm talking about is fundamentally the baseline. When we talk about 100 years of protection, that's by no means adequate. That means that over a 30-year mortgage, you still have a 25% chance of being flooded. So I wouldn't call that adequate protection. But it's a great baseline, and if it gets put in place, it'll be the best protection New Orleans has actually physically had. So I'm encouraged about that. I won't go over the history of this except to say I think Chip covered this far better than I will, but these migrating river channels left in their path very complex soil situations that had a lot to do with the performance of the hurricane protection system. So I'll talk about that a little bit. A lot of it has to deal with the Holocene sediments. This is the mush that's been deposited in the last 7,000 years. In the New Orleans area, it's on the order of 50 to 100 feet deep. So that's the material that any kind of a protective system has to deal with, and it's quite difficult. New Orleans in 1849, people wisely lived along the natural river levee, and the area to the north was considered uninhabitable. At that time, it was at or above sea level. The three dots that are there on the upper part of the screen are the locations of the 17th Street and London Avenue flood wall breaches. And those are very, of course, now very high density residential areas where a lot of damage and loss of life occurred. Subsidence was mentioned. There's regional subsidence to deal with that varies from a foot or two per century to, in the New Orleans area, around a half a foot per century. But far more serious is the subsidence because of what we have done as in developing the land in New Orleans. And the lower left is a map developed from RadarSat that shows the rate of subsidence and how variable it is. And some of those values are in the 20 to 30 millimeters per year range, the more orange and red colors. That's pretty rocket speed for subsidence. And that's occurring because of development of the land, pumping of groundwater out of the land, the oxidation of organic soils. And this was a set of data projections that was developed back in the early 80s by two folks that I had the pleasure of working with in Vicksburg. And they projected that from the early 70s or early 20s out through about today, there could be up to 80 or so inches of subsidence. If groundwater, if development continued in those marsh areas and groundwater continued to be pumped out and so on, and I think they're within 6 inches of being right on. This was for the Kenner area, but it's an example of the seriousness of living, working, playing, and operating in an environment like this with an urban environment. One of the things we found when we started looking at the system in New Orleans after Katrina was that we really didn't know how high anything was. The geodetic reference datum was not up to date. The National Geodetic Survey and the Corps of Engineers had been working piecemeal at it, but there again, it was the old funding thing. So we ended up, because we had the funding, we ended up basically mapping the entire area with LIDAR using differential GPS to reestablish the geodetic datum. And we found that there were some flood walls that were literally built 2 feet too low. And there were some other flood walls and levees that had subsided to be 2.5 or more feet below the original intended elevation of those flood walls. So subsidence, the geotechnical environment here had a huge impact on simple elevation of some of those structures, which certainly impacted the amount of overtopping that could occur from them and their performance. But this is the picture today. And of course, you've seen this picture before. And for those of you that don't live, work, and play here, you're sitting on pretty high ground right now over here on the natural levee of the Mississippi. The hurricane protection system, I mentioned, is 350 miles of levees, mostly earth levees, many miles of flood walls, and a lot of pumping stations that aren't really part of the, and I've got a picture of one inset there that's at the end of the 17th Street Canal. They're not really part of the hurricane protection system. They're basically to drain rainwater and groundwater out of New Orleans. But they're massive. They're massive. This one in particular could fill the Superdome in 30 minutes with the pumps that are in it. So this is a massive amount of pumping capacity that's here, and there are 80 pump stations at least in New Orleans that are here to keep New Orleans dry. These are the key structures. The big villain were the eye walls. They were the walls that breached before the water got to the design elevation. The majority of the breaches occurred because of overtopping and erosion of the levees, of earth levees, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. If I can get this to move. Yeah, try that. Thanks. Katrina was a very complex storm. It went from a Category 1 in Florida to a Category 5, back to a Category 3. And one of the things we learned was that the intensity of the storm is one thing, but it's not a very good measure of surge. And if you don't also incorporate the size of the storm, the radius to maximum winds, that you really don't have a good measure of the impact of the storm. So the Saffir-Simpson scale is a great meteorological tool, but it's not a great surge tool. And so Katrina as a Category 3 was much less intense than Camille, a Category 5 in 1969, but much, much larger in size. And so it had a lot more total energy, a lot higher surge generation potential than Camille. In fact, a lot higher surge generation potential than the two Category 5 storms that hit Mexico this year. And it was because of its size. It had that unique combination, and it created the largest surge that ever hit North America. It also created a surge larger than that from the Indonesian tsunami, if you count look at the Mississippi coastline. So this was a big storm. This was a whopper. And we looked at it in great detail, and Dr. Dean, who follows me, is the real expert on this. And I won't dwell on it, but it was the surge and wave environment that was important, not the storm. And so we focused a lot on what was the surge and wave environment that was created, and what were the forces that subjected to the on the structures. We modeled the waves for the entire Gulf of Mexico in one of DOD's largest supercomputers. We predicted the first time a wave height of 55 feet somewhere off the coast of the Bird's Foot Delta, and we said, this can't be right. And then we found a NOAA gauge that measured a 53-point-some-foot wave in that location, and we said, well, we got that model calibrated. So it was amazing the severity of the environment that this big storm created. But it was critical. Waves were very, very critical and a very significant part of the forces that the structures experienced. And then we modeled surge. This is just the peak surge. We used a model called ADCERC with a 2 million node grid. We had to use very, very high resolution because we couldn't get the water balance right unless we modeled a lot of the channels that are in the marshes and in the wetlands that really are the way that water gets conveyed in and out of the marshes. So just looking at the roughness of the marsh was not adequate to accurately predict the surge and wave environment. But we did this, and then Dr. Dean and his team also did high-resolution hydrodynamics within the canals, within the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal and the outfall canals. So we really did understand the forces that the structures were subjected to. Of course, this is the flooding that occurred, in some cases over 15 feet deep. This mimics that topo map that I showed you earlier. Obviously, the water goes downhill. The red dots there are where eye wall sections failed prior to water reaching their design elevation. The blue dots are where eye walls were overtopped and the erosion behind the eye wall reduced the stability of the wall and it collapsed. And the yellow are areas where levee breaches occurred, and those breaches occurred from water overtopping the levees and eroding them from basically from the backside. And when water erosion is as you're probably well aware, is in relation to the third power of water velocity, and water cascading down over the backsides of the levees had three times the velocity of the water on the front side of the levees. So there was 27 times more potential for erosion there, and these levees basically eroded from behind, and to allow a lot of water to get in. This is the surface geology in the New Orleans area, and you're seeing some of those old distributary channels that from those other from the river channels of the past, and the swamp-like materials in between, and the red dots there are where some of those breaches occurred. This is a cross-section at the 17th Street Canal, and there's a levee there with a flood wall, sheet piles sticking down in through a 10 or 15 foot peat layer and then into a lacustrine clay. That clay was very weak, very low shear strength, and then below that is a sand. When you move over towards the London Avenue Canal, that sand, that lacustrine clay goes away and the sand becomes the dominant foundation material underneath the peat. And this is that old Pine Ridge beach sand that I'm talking about under the London Avenue sites. So here's the flood wall behavior. The culprit in each case was the flood wall tilting slightly from the hydrostatic pressure and allowing pressure to go down the front face of the flood wall and basically separating the levee into two pieces. And in the case at the top where we're talking about clay, the back of the levee just wasn't, with that weak clay foundation, it wasn't strong enough to do the job of the whole levee. And the levee, that back half of the levee was translated backwards 40 to 60 feet. In the case of the sand areas on London Avenue, the hydrostatic pressure got down into the porous sand because of that deflection, caused a lot of uplift pressure on the back side of the levee, and basically it blew out. And there was an enormous amount of sand that eroded out of from under the levee onto the protected side. And of course, the flood walls collapsed. That's a picture of the failure plain. We used a very sophisticated tool called a backhoe to find that. And we did a lot of numerical analysis. This is with Plaxis, looking at shear stresses and strains. We looked at a lot of seepage analysis. And because we had very little other data, we had to rely a lot on modeling and simulation. But we used two different teams. We used a team at Virginia Tech, and we used another team in Vicksburg, basically working independently and then comparing their results. Again, because of the speed we were working, we couldn't afford to believe one answer and not confirm it. But we also did physical testing, and we used centrifuge at RPI and in Vicksburg to create a 1 in 50 scale model of these levee and floodwall sections in the subsurface. And when you spin that at 50 Gs, you end up with the same force distribution within the model that you had in reality in, when the levees were experiencing those forces. And if we had more time, I would show you a video of this, and if anyone wants to see it, I have it with me later. But this confirmed the failure modes that we had hypothesized through the numerical analysis and through the data collection in the field. This is the flood wall that was overtopped on the left. It didn't get scoured out enough to fail, but on the right it did. That's in the lower ninth. And this is what used to be a levee. This is out along the Mr. Go, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet in St. Bernard. And this map shows the correlation between the kind of material that was in the levees and the performance. And the magenta areas were essentially built with hydraulic fill. And the brown areas on the right were built with clay. And there's pretty much a one-to-one correlation. Anything built of clay was very resilient to overtopping. Anything built of the hydraulic fill, even though it was capped with quite a bit of clay in some cases, could not withstand the erosion, and that's where the breaching occurred. There's some real-life data. This is done by out at Texas A&M, looking at the correlation between erosion and velocity and the kinds of soils that actually occurred in the levees. So here we are today. We have a hurricane protection system that's been upgraded considerably. It's all been repaired. There are three major floodgates and temporary floodgates and pumping stations at the ends of the outfall canals to protect those canals from surge getting into the city again. A much more rigorous system than what was in place prior to Katrina, but still not what New Orleans needs and not nearly a 100-year system. So how do you know what the situation is here? How do you really understand from a big picture systems perspective where do we stand with this? And here's the plan for 2011, raising a lot of these structures to higher elevations, putting in navigable surge gates at the ends of the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, and so on. A much more rigorous system. But again, how do you know what to do? How can you look at this from a systems perspective? To do that, I'm going to not bore you with all these individual ones, but let you see the whole thing. We took fairly traditional risk and reliability analysis and applied it to the entire system. The first part of this was defining the hazard. To do that, we ran 152 hypothetical hurricanes through the supercomputer to predict surge and waves. Those range from about 300-year meteorological events to 6,000-year meteorological events. So we're biasing this towards understanding performance in large storms. Katrina, by the way, was about a 400-year meteorological event. That ended up in giving us about 63,000 hydrographs from hurricanes that became our hazard. We ran that against a reliability analysis by breaking the entire system up into 138 reaches and 200 other special features like gates that needed to be closed, our pumping stations, and so on. And we coupled that with losses. Now, the losses are focused strictly on pre-Katrina conditions, But consequences are the key thing for understanding risk. And all of this work is available on the website that I have there on the bottom. And this is the result. This is a composite map of the risk of, this is not risk, this is probability of inundation. So this is looking at the 1% per year situation of flooding. This is kind of like FEMA's 100-year floodplain, but for hurricanes. The depth of flooding you would expect at the 1% chance per year prior to Katrina. This is the old hurricane protection system. And you can see there are some areas that have a whole lot of risk, a whole lot of threat of flooding. This is basically June of 07. Now, there's not a whole lot of difference. There are some areas you can see in St. Bernard and up along the 17th Street Canal where there are differences, but that's because of the kinds of repairs and rebuilding that was done. When the 100-year system gets put in place, this is what it looks like. Dramatically different, and fundamentally, this is all rainwater. There's almost no overtopping or any kind of hurricane water getting into New Orleans basin with this protection system in place, except rainfall from the hurricanes. That means the pumping system is extremely critical to keeping New Orleans dry, and the pumping system is not there yet to be able to deal with this. The pumping system can deal with about a 10-year rainfall event. So that's going to be one of the keys for the future. If you start putting the consequences in, this is the Lower Ninth Ward map prior to Katrina. This is the Lower Ninth Ward today. And if you start looking at the what has happened so far has reduced the depth of the 100-year, or the elevation of the 100-year flood by 2.5 feet. And it's done something to reduce the potential for fatalities, but not a whole lot. But if you go to the projected system, there's a very dramatic change in the picture. And now you're starting to look at dimensions like the percent reduction in fatalities, the percent reduction in property damages that politicians understand. And this is, I think, one of the things I'm excited about is this is a tool for the public to have the exact same information as public officials and for everyone to have a common understanding of what the situation is and what you're dealing with. One of the key things for this in the future is to add some arrows to this. We've got to add environment in here as a consequence. We've got to add social and cultural aspects of losses as a consequence so that this gives a complete picture for policymakers and politicians to really understand the full consequences of what a protection system can do, what are the real implications of combining and how do you best combine natural protection with physical protection, because that's about the only way we're going to get to a higher level of protection in the future. Thank you.